episode in the conversation series that Vini Maharashtra will be hosting this year. The conversation series is called Up the Ante Mumbai, Uch Apeksha. And the idea behind this conversation series actually came to the team, you know, we were ideating about it last year, sometime I think in July or August. We had launched a book suggesting 15 legal reforms for the state government of Maharashtra. And we launched the book last year in June, and we had a panel discussion to sort of launch the book. Ma'am was also a part of that panel discussion. And we had a very enthusiastic audience that day. We had a musical performance. After the panel discussion, there were some interesting observations that came from the discussion. I think one sort of observation that came from that discussion was, you know, this idea of moving away from sustainability to the idea of just cities, because the conversation and the panel discussion was, the topic of the discussion was balancing economic progress and ecological sustainability. And once that panel discussion got over, I think one of the conversations that happened was that let's talk about just cities, let's talk about fair cities. And even after the panel discussion, we had a lot of young students, people come to us sort of and tell us that they were very happy to be a part of that discussion, that they wanted to be a part of more such discussions like this. And you know, there was this recurring question as to what they could do to, you know, contribute to law and policy making in the state, make a difference, etc. And that sort of got us thinking that perhaps we should do more of these conversations, and we should do it on a sustained basis, in a focused manner. And that's the idea behind this conversation series. It was sort of born that way. And what we thought was that given this year that we are going to polls at the national level, at the state assembly level, perhaps, I don't know, at the BNC level as well, it is even more important to have these conversations this year. And we decided to sort of start this series and pick up like one, you know, urban planning or governance issue in our immediate surroundings, which is Bombay. Call a subject matter expert and have a deep dive into that sort of issue, discuss law and policy suggestions, and sort of go at it in a very targeted and focused manner as opposed to, you know, a surface level manner. So that was the idea behind the conversation series. The first episode of the conversation series is on today, and I have with me our first speaker, Dr. Amita Bhire, who's currently a professor at the Tata Institute of Social Sciences. And, you know, ma'am has a very illustrious career. She has been involved in issues related to urban poor communities, community organization and housing rights movement, and advocacy too. She's extensively researched on urban development, urban local governance, planning, water and sanitation, housing and land issues. And professor is not just an academic, she's also headed several action research projects that seek to create a model of inclusive development in Indian cities. Not just this, Professor Bhire also heads the Transforming M Ward project, which is a field action project working in the M East Ward in Mumbai. So she also has some ground level experience coming through her research, through her field action projects. So we thought that, you know, we could have Ma'am come and speak to us today about Mumbai's relationship with its informal urban settlements. That is something what the law terms as slums. So just the idea as to how this relationship has evolved over the years, what are law and policy responses to these urban settlements, where is the law and policy failing, and what can we do to sort of, you know, fix those gaps in law and policy. So that is the idea behind the first conversation that we are going to do today. And without further ado, I think I'll just start off with my first question, ma'am. Firstly, thank you for being a part of this conversation. You've been a part of previous city events as well, and we're very grateful to have you today as well. The first question that I have for you is actually, I'll just start off with some data, you know, for the audience actually, is that as per the national sample survey data of 2012, Maharashtra has the highest number of slums in urban India. Over 20% of the total slums in urban India are located in Maharashtra, and this houses close to 40% of urban India's total slum dwelling population. The average slum size in also the highest in Maharashtra. And as per information placed before the parliament in 2022, Mumbai, India's financial capital, has around 2,400 slums. as per the 2011 census, this is very dated information, approximately 6.53 million people, that is around 40 to 42% of the city's population is living in slums. I think the number is much higher, it's close to 50%, but this is as per census 2011. So much so that we've now had an Oscar winning movie that was based on Mumbai slums, you know. And contrastingly, Maharashtra is also the richest state in the country and it has the financial capital. So you see this sort of contrast happening in terms of the kind of people who are living in these informal settlements and the state's gross state domestic product, you know, its contribution to the Indian economy, etc. And it's very difficult to sort of, you know, reconcile these two things is the first thought that I have. So my first question to you actually is that you've studied the very cities, you've studied the city very closely, and also, you know, I've read your fantastic profile on the socio-spatial transformation of the city of Bombay right from the colonial times up until today. So my question to you is, what are some of the main reasons that we are here today, you know, in this sort of a position that I just narrated by way of facts, what are some of the main reasons we are here today?
So I'd like to respond, firstly, thanks, Vidhi, and to you as well, Jinali. Both for, I think the idea behind the conversations itself is very interesting. And I'm happy to be a contributor to whatever value that it adds to this and to public discourses in the city. Because I do think that Mumbai as a city desperately needs public discourses and much more debate around issues. And we are fairly silent about that in many, many ways. Okay. Having said that, to come to the very specific question that you asked, I'm going to respond to this question in two ways. Firstly, I think our assumption is that the slum as a category or as whatever label has remained the same through the days of colonialism to now. Whereas I will argue that the form of the slum, the nature of the slum, why slums exist, are all very, very different in all of these three periods. I'll just give a very brief illustration here. So, when we became independent at that point in time, roughly around 1947 or so, it was estimated that Mumbai had about 5% people in slums. Okay? And when that is contrasted with the 1976 was the first time that a slum census was organized in the city. At that time, we came up with the number of 40% of the city's population coming up in slums. And what is the obvious conclusion that gets drawn from this? Hey, how bad we are, right? There were only 5% slums before independence. The British were able to manage the city much better, right? But the real reality of the fact is really that the colonizers were very, very effective in exporting the issues outside the boundary of the city, right? So for example, tanning as an economic activity or alcohol brewing as an activity, though the British, I mean, there were no restrictions or norms around not drinking, etc. This is a very permissive society in terms of drinking alcohol, but yet drinking and brewing alcohol was definitely considered to be not belonging in the city. So both of these activities were just kind of banned in the city and they were compelled to move outside. Okay. Where did they move outside? To a group of island or island called Dharavi. And this is actually the beginning of Dharavi. Okay. But Dharavi was then outside the city, outside the limits of the city. So its population doesn't get counted within the city. So the 5% that we are talking of are all manual labor, largely head loaders and others who work in the docks. Okay. And at that point in time, even areas like which comprised of more dilapidated buildings or inadequate building structures were called slums. So this is the form of the slum in pre-colonial Bombay. Right. Come to post-independence, there are two things which really in some ways let loose. Okay? The first is the fact that we continue to grow our industries in Mumbai. So in addition to textile mills which had already begun in the city, there were now engineering industries, pharmaceutical industries, There were chemical industries which were added to the mix, and all of these required labor, blue-collar labor, which may not be skilled labor, which really required hard toil. Right? There was a lot of public sector development, and in order to serve public sector employees, you bring in a set of service giving people and service providers. Right? So Shirish Patel, one of the very renowned planners and engineers who has contributed a lot to the city, estimates that for every one formal sector job which is created, there are 8 informal sector people who come to the city. So now you can estimate what began to happen to Mumbai, what kind of people then started migrating in to Mumbai, and where would they stay? Because by this time, housing had really assumed a crisis form. And the nature of slums, which therefore got created in the post-independence era, where really people coming from different regions from Mumbai, they were migrants, and they really formed the backbone of labor. Or as Dr. Sandeep Pinse calls it, they were the shramiks or the toilers of the city. I think that's the very, where did they live? Now they began to live on extremely risky lands, because post-independence also brought in a level of planning which tried to cover the entire city. And with that kind of master planning, there was no space for the poor at all, especially no lands for the poor. So the poor started occupying environmentally risky lands, fringe lands, marginal lands, or made lands from forests, from swamps, right? And this is the nature of the slum in the post-independence period. We come to a third period where industry started declining and real estate started emerging as the big economy of the city. And that is where you now see that the term slum, the phenomenon of the slum, gets very different dimensions. Because now what the slum is basically, A, it becomes a real estate frontier. Second, it becomes a political constituency. Thirdly, it becomes a service provider's den. Fourthly, it becomes a hub of industry, informal industry. Because while manufacturing couldn't survive in the city, in the large setups that it had, all the industry that exists in Mumbai currently is basically in slums. So if you look at Dharavi, for example, it's really, I mean, you cannot imagine Dharavi as just an area where there are residents. It's not a residential area. It's a highly industrial and commercial, not just commercial, industrial and commercial area. So I think this term slum is firstly not the same. The form had changed. The second part of this question that you asked me is giving me the statistics of Maharashtra and also talking about the contrast between prosperity on one hand and the formation of the slum on the other. Okay? And I would say that it is like the nature of prosperity that we have also demands the kind of inequity, and given the kind of inequity, demands the slum. Okay? Both of them go hand in hand. The same forces that create prosperity are also the same forces which also create the slum. And I think that is something which definitely needs to be borne in mind. The kind of pattern of and the way we have used urban development in Maharashtra, which is very, very spatially focused, and the kind of investments in big capital, the lack of opportunities for the toilers to the perhaps the low skill employment, it's mismatched with the kind of in-migration which happens to the city. I think all of this is really reflected in this high proportion of slum dwellers in Maharashtra.
Thank you. So I think it's quite interesting, you know, is what you said is that both, you need one for the other to survive. You know, it goes hand in hand. Because what I see is, and you've written quite extensively about it, is that you want these people to work for you. You want their labor, but yet you don't want to acknowledge their very existence when you are planning your cities. Which gets me to my second question, which is on planning laws and policies. So the Maharashtra Regional and Town Planning Act, you have the concept of a development plan, which is supposed to be made once every 20 years. And do these development plans, firstly, are they even implemented? Secondly, do they make sense in the current context? I mean, can we do a long-term vision of 20 years for a city by way of a development plan? Do these development plans even account for these people in the slums? You know? And if not, if these plans are failing, if they are not being implemented, if they are not realistic, if they are not accounting for all people in the city, you know, is there scope for us to review our planning laws, you know, and policies and, you know, perhaps revamp them, you know? So what are your thoughts on that, and what is the sort of reform needed when we are planning our cities, is my second question.
It's a very important question, but equally difficult to also perhaps respond to. So my first question, I think the reflection part on the review of the plans, I think is a little simpler one. I'll begin with that. Because I think the relationship between planning and the formation or creating space for inclusion is really a very antithetical one. There are very few plans which are implemented unless they are in the capital cities, like NCR has a fairly large proportion of implementation, or you may see this in Chandigarh or Bhubaneswar, or perhaps Rourkela, some of the public sector cities like Bhilai and so on. Okay. But otherwise, in Mumbai, the proportion has ranged from 8% to 10-12%. That's it. Okay. But my question, I think the real point of reflection is, what would have happened if all the plans were implemented worthy? Okay. And the results would have been disastrous for the poor. Okay. Disastrous in two ways. Okay. So I'll first talk about what is proposed in the plan. Okay. Within planning frameworks itself, there is no acknowledgement of who are we planning for. Okay. So it talks of a generalized public interest. Okay. And that is where I think planning goes firstly kind of weak on its overall premise. Okay. There is something called generalized public interest, which is not classed or which is not divided across different segments. That's like the first thing. And the experience all over the country, including Mumbai, of specific provisions for economically weaker sections, as they call them, have been very bad. For example, there was a time where a lot of private land was thought to be acquired by plans, or how state housing boards creating spaces through plans and allocating, let's say, for example, Madhya Pradesh has a very explicit provision of 10% EWS housing, okay, or 10% provisioning for EWS in the form of plots. Okay. These have subsequently then also been taken on by some other cities. For example, Pune has this provision. The actual evaluation of many of these actually suggests that all of these spaces have actually been appropriated by the not so poor. Okay. In fact, so there are many other these kind of subversions of the plans. Okay. There is the other part of the plans, right? And the other part of the plans is the existing settlements, however, are completely absent on the plan. And the most interesting example perhaps that I would suggest is in the 1960s plan, where just prior to the plan, Mumbai's boundaries had been extended to take on Salset and other regions. The train had also started moving beyond Andheri and as suburban train. There were fairly large numbers of chawls just beyond Andheri, in Jogeshwari, in Goregaon. So, and these are all located really on private lands. So after the slum laws came, came in, the Chols get a nomenclature of their slums. In the 1964 development plan, none of these settlements are shown as existing, though many of them show an existence which is even prior. Okay? So they are there, but they are not seen on the development plan. And therefore, the proposed land use plan in the development plan shows that there will be 40 meter wide roads or 80 meter wide roads which will be created as a east-west link for Mumbai. For nearly 30 years, nothing happens. Sab kuch al-bail, the settlements are growing, there is no road, it's only a proposed road. Then comes in the World Bank. Okay? And the World Bank proposes a transport project, which is now called the Mumbai Urban Transport Project. And with the help of the World Bank funds, then a resettlement policy which is set into motion, the Jogeshwari Vikhroli Link Road takes shape. All of these people and all of these settlements are then considered encroachers. Okay? So the simple question to ask is, what came first, the settlement or the plan? Okay? So here the plan came later in this case, but yet the entire invisibility in the plan is something that has not been, that has immense repercussions. Subsequently, in the current development plan which was being made, there was an entire campaign in the city which tried to argue and basically say that all existing settlements need to be recorded in the ALU. Okay? After a lot of struggle, they did get recorded. But how? As large resettlement areas with no boundaries. So this is the first time that it had happened. And this resistance actually tells you, firstly, that underlying the premise of the plan is basically that a plan is made by property holders. They are considered the single most important stakeholder in relation to the plan. And whatever we talk of as public interest, inclusion, the objectives of the plan, all of these are actually in some ways secondary. Now, what should we do? That's the third part of your question, right? What should we do? How should we reform this system? This kind of a planning won't work if we are to really think of inclusive planning. We need to change the entire paradigm of planning itself and shift it from land ownership or property ownership to thinking about other claim making to the city. Just to give one example here, in Brazil in 2001, post a revolution in Brazil, they brought in a right to city statute. Okay? And the minute the right to city statute was brought in, they said one of the ways in which one can execute right to city is via urban planning. So now the purpose of urban planning itself is shifted. It is no more that abstract public interest, but it also explicitly becomes to deliver the right to city to all citizens, including the most vulnerable, giving them a priority, but also others.
No, I think that's again very interesting. One of the earlier thoughts that we had about this conversation series was to actually call it the Right to the City series. And that's the idea I took to ma'am. And I remember you asking me, over the phone call, Janani, who has the right to the city? You know, is it only people who have property in the city? Are you going to tell me that only they have the right to the city? Do migrants who come in and out of the city, perhaps live in different areas, but come to Bombay, work throughout the day, generate like economic activity for the city, do they not have a right to the city? I remember thinking about it and we were discussing it, and eventually we sort of moved away from the Right to the City conversation series to what it is today. But that always stayed with me, and which is why we decided to do this first conversation also on this particular issue, because one of the questions that we want to ask with respect under this conversation series is not so much as a juridical right, because then you end up in all sorts of legal tangles, hassles, you know, is right to say we are recognized right by the Supreme Court or not? You know, what have courts said about it? How can you read it under the Constitution, etc.? And if you wanted to avoid that sort of legal hassle for now and sort of just ask people, what are your expectations from the city? And, you know, I think people living across the city, irrespective of whether they are living in a slum settlement, an informal settlement, or a regular housing, expect very basic amenities from the city. They deserve good housing. People want, you know, clean water, electricity. They want like a, you know, hospital right next to their house. They want a good school for their children. So the first question, you know, that we were trying to answer was, you know, what are your expectations from the city? And I think we should be speaking for all residents of the city, irrespective of whether they have a property right or not. Because only once we shift from this propertied model to a right to city model, where we speak about all residents, can we actually think about inclusive urbanism. And I think you also mentioned this concept coming from colonial times, which is that, you know, the earliest cooperators in the Bombay Municipal Corporation were people who were residents, who had property. Only then they could vote. And that sort of idea has now trickled into even post-independence, where we are only talking about people who have property and who then can enjoy a whole bunch of rights that come with living in a city. So I come to my third question, ma'am, you know, and this is, again, this is, you know, now coming to the Slum Act itself, which is the Slum Improvement and Clearance Act. And you've written about, you just said that the concept of slum has evolved over the years. You've also written about how the law and policy approach to slums has evolved over the years. So earlier it was this idea of negation. It was the idea that we have to demolish them, that they are encroachers, they are an illegal land. To this, you know, sort of tacit acceptance, tolerance towards slum. Although that shift is still not very clear, because we still have penalty provisions under the Act that penalizes encroachers. But this evolution has happened under law and policy, where we have now moved from, you know, let's clear them out, let's demolish them. They are all on illegal, you know, they're all illegal occupants on government land. Most of them are on government lands. To this sort of idea of tacit tolerance, where we're talking about rehabilitation, redevelopment, resettlement. And over here, I mean, I see two problems to it that you also identify. One is that, interestingly, this shift from negation to sort of acceptance has gone hand in hand with the introduction of market-linked development incentives, which is basically the TDR, the transferable development right. So, and this TDR used both in the context of slum redevelopment and, you know, infrastructure projects, big time infrastructure projects, has sort of gone hand in hand with this state acceptance, you know, towards slums. What we've also seen is the withdrawal of the state in some way from this entire housing sector, and more private sector intervention, where the state is actually allowing private parties to intervene and develop these projects, take up these projects, and, you know, sort of withdrawing in the background from the duties it owes to its residents, you know, in guaranteeing them housing. What has happened as a result of this entire thing is now that we see unequal development, and the stats that you've provided are interestingly, I think, you know, you say at one point of time more than 50% of the TDR that was generated in the M East ward was not consumed within that ward, but was consumed in the western suburbs. So TDR generated in slums, you know, then utilized in the more prosperous western suburbs where land values are higher. So there seems to be this unequal development happening across the city, where it's all not uniform, you know. So that's one problem, this unequal development, which then you also argue leads to social inequality. The social fabric of the city changes. And the second thing, which, you know, you speak about through case studies, and it's you know, quite detailed, etc., is how the resettlement and rehabilitation program itself leads to widespread displacement of people, a loss of community for people. And it's not like that, you know, when people move to these resettled colonies, they have better access to services. So your studies show, for example, with the Mumbai Urban IT Transformation Project, the BT Project, etc., once people move to these resettled colonies, survey results showed that it's not like they have better access to water. It's not like they have better access to education. You're just putting them from like a horizontal slum to a vertical slum, and that took kilometers away from where their original community was. So there are these two problems which we see in the way the slum act is playing out, in the way this rehabilitation is playing out. So again, coming back to, and I see that as a lawyer, very conscious of the fact that law is a very limited sort of instrument that can bring about change. The law is only as good as the people who implement the law. But yet, coming back to again the law and policy, with these two problems in mind, you know, what do you think is the solution to these two problems? It's, I know, massive. It's also like perhaps the answer is not in the law, you would tell me. But still, I would like to hear your thoughts on it.
Actually, I do believe that law is a very powerful instrument, especially in our context. And I would also believe that Maharashtra and was a pioneer when it passed the Slum Act. There was no other state at that point in time which had a Slum Act. Okay? And the Slum Act automatically did two things. Number one, it empowered the state to declare a slum area. And we just think of declaration as a neutral act. But for me, I think when you look at it on the ground, it creates grounds for the state to actually intervene even in private area developments and speculations and giving of basic services. Many people are perhaps not aware of this, but there is also Section 14, if I am not wrong, in the Slum Act, which also talks about if there is a cooperative society of the occupants of a settlement which comes together, pays something like 40 times the rent that they are currently paying, then they can be given the rights to that land. Okay. So there are extremely interesting provisions which are there, and I think it is the Slum Act which signaled this kind of a tolerance. It created a way for giving basic services to settlements. Interestingly, in the country in 1972, there was an environmental improvement of urban slum scheme which was brought in. But remember, Maharashtra brought in an act. The country brought in a scheme. Okay? And a scheme can always change. But I think there were these kind of grounds which were created in Maharashtra, which later on also went to a 1976 slum census. Again, the first initiative in the entire country, something which was a collaborative action in which housing rights activists participated. A person like Madan Naik, whom I respect tremendously, who is no more today, but he, secretary like Gautam Chatterjee and the then chief secretary, who all backed up this exercise. Just imagine 40% of the city's population being enumerated, censused in the span of a single day, as is on this basis. After that, this exercise has not been repeated. But if you come to the Slum Act now, what is being done? And this is a Maharashtra Slum Act, it's not a Mumbai Slum Act. Okay? But the current versions of the Slum Act have done two things which are extremely wrong. In small articles, I have also written on this, but maybe these are not, I don't even know now whether they are on academia or whatever. Okay? But in 2001-2002, after the slum rehabilitation scheme was brought into Maharashtra, there are two things which are being done. Number one, the provisions in the Act now talk of only a provision of resettlement or rehabilitation. Okay? So what the entire title of the previous Act read, slum areas, declaration, improvement, relocation. So there were 3-4 things. Okay? And now it becomes solely focused on rehabilitation. It introduces such penal provisions that if you refuse rehabilitation, you will not get another opportunity to get resettled. Okay? So just think of how there is now a homogeneity which is created within the Act. Instead of having an umbrella of approaches that can be done, you now have one singular approach. Okay? The second, there was an accompanying act which was brought in, and which is like a version of, I would say, it is called the Slum Dada Act, very popularly. Okay? But it is like a version of the TADA. Okay? And what it does is, encroachment becomes a non-bailable crime here. And through this, then the state found a fantastic way of acting. Okay, so you carry out the eviction, okay, and people who are poor, they recreate the structure. So now, once you have recreated the structure, you are a encroacher. So if you look at the kind of penalization, there are some lawyers, I think Maruk has done some study of this, and they find that if you look at what are the kind of crimes which have been registered under this Slum Dada Act, who has been penalized, because this act also provides for penalization of officers, etc. There are no officers who have been tried under the act against whom a crime is registered. It is all the slum dwellers. So I think it is important to see what is happening in the law itself. The third reflection is at the level of rules in the act. Okay? So who should declare a slum? Previously, the powers used to be with the collector. And the collector used to declare a slum and publish a list. Okay? Subsequently, now look at this for Maharashtra. The powers to declare a slum are now only with the state government and the UD department. So for people from different towns in Maharashtra, there is an extreme centralization which has happened. And I think often many of us don't think about this. Even through the rehabilitation mode, we are now saying that within the entire state of Maharashtra, nothing else can happen legally. The ultimate aim is to create rehabilitation schemes. Okay? There can be no upgradations possible even in the smaller towns of Maharashtra, where I think they are not as big real estate havens as Mumbai. Right? There could be a other variety of options which are available there. Okay? But I think what we have persisted in doing is this kind of a homogenized, highly imposing real estate linked solution that one is bringing. In fact, I would say that the phenomenon of the slum, even as a real estate or a land-linked thing, is also widely varying in Mumbai. So for example, you will have central government lands, multiple, port trust, railways, forest, airports, defense, and posts, and so on and so forth. One can keep on adding to this. Then there are private lands, right? Privately owned land. 47% of slums in Mumbai are on private lands. Then one will also see lands which are situated and have multiple forms of tenancy. For example, Ramabai Colony at Koper, a huge settlement. But it began as a municipal workers' colony. So there are chores constructed by the municipal corporation where workers are paying rent. So you will see these kind of kernels, I would say. They are small pieces. But so the slum reality is also not all of encroachment, etc. But what we are trying to do is we are homogenizing everything. Poliwada has become slums. Now, of course, there is a contestation linked to that. I'm happy about that. But everything one becomes a slum. Something which is not a building becomes a slum. Okay? So I think this is what is. And then what we do is to facilitate that creation of what they call as a formal settlement, there are two very big things besides all the impacts of displacement, etc. that you talked about. I want to just bring to your notice two things. The development plan of Mumbai, the base document of the development plan, not my statistic, that itself acknowledges that if you look at the overall land which is occupied by slums, especially in slum rehab areas, it gets reduced to 33% of the original area. So what does that mean? That in every slum rehab scheme, as a thumb rule, this is not you go scheme by scheme, but 66% of the area gets used for profit purpose. And all the existing slum dwellers get accommodated on 1/3 of the land. So now look at the density proportions. Already we had roughly 50% of the population of the city staying on 7 to 8% of the land. Now you are going to reduce it to 1/3 of that land if all the slums So it is in some ways a structurally violent exercise. The second, to facilitate further the terms of the slum rehabilitation scheme, the density norms, the kinds of FARs which are given have been increased to, I would say, intolerable limits. Okay? And I think that is the other dangerous part of this entire thing. So what is our logic in giving rehabilitation or creating a rehabilitation scheme? The report of the Afzalpurkar committee, which kind of formulated the slum rehabilitation schemes, is basically that we want to improve the living conditions of people. The second thing it says is that this is a report which acknowledges that slum dwellers have created value. So one is giving back that value. So these two things are there in the Afzalpurkar committee. But on the other hand, the kind of density norms that one is creating, one is really creating vertical slums in many ways. They may look great. Okay? And I think fortunately there are some slum rehab schemes which look now huge. They don't suffer from some of the deficiencies that I've seen previously. Like one of the first slum rehab schemes which was created in the city is one for Banjaras, Roma Banjara Tanda, it is called, located in Manpur. Okay, today if you will go to that society and see those buildings, they are 7-story buildings, but the last 3 stories, every room and the corridors have a cloth tied on the roof. That is the amount of leakage that they suffer. Okay? So you can imagine the state of the buildings. The corridors are dark, the corridors are double loaded. Okay? So there is hardly any light and ventilation within. So these were the first, you know, where usually you had developers who were, extremely problematic developers. Often they didn't have enough working capital. So they start 3 schemes. That kind of a thing. Today you see large developers. And when I've seen large developers, like if you look at Omkar's work in Malad, Indore Parel, and Sivri, and so on and so forth, okay? The schemes look good. You will have like German Schindler lifts and all of that, right? But the question is, when you are creating 30 story, 40 story, is one ever thinking of maintenance? And what are the maintenance costs which are being imposed in the long run, short run? Jab tak developer hai, 5-7 saal nikal jayenge, uske baad kya? Or is this one way of gentrification? Because then there will be other ways in which people will move out voluntarily out of these kind of buildings, and one will shift the slum problem from a Mumbai location to perhaps a peripheral location in Airoli, in Meera Bhayandar, or perhaps in Nalasopara. No? So one has not solved the problem. No, one has only shifted the location.
So then would you say that, you know, this focus on rehabilitation under the law in any which way, and also the sort of like linkage with the real estate industry by way of these development incentives, you know, is that something that we would definitely need to work towards and revamp?
Absolutely. So I do believe that redevelopment or use of market incentives has a place. Okay? I'm not someone as an academic who believes that one should go against them. Okay? In fact, the slums are also a creation of the market and the state. You know? I'm a very firm believer in that. Okay? So if that is so, I think if one has to combine and balance multiple objectives, one should be able to provide an umbrella of solutions. Okay? Because in some places, people themselves will be able to mobilize the resources and decide the direction of their development. And that is a freedom that one should allow. Okay? Similarly, there could be options such as self-redevelopment. There could be other kinds of imageries. Right? And redevelopment can be one of those.
That's great, ma'am. And you know, I want to pick on something that you mentioned quite early on, and you've written quite extensively about this, is the violence, you know, the structural violence that is inflicted on people who are living in these informal urban settlements, by state actors, by non-state actors, violence in like multiple forms. Could you just, and you call them as spaces, like a space of exception, you know, that is where we get the topic for today's conversation. We call them spaces of exception because you call them spaces of exception. So just for the audience, could you firstly tell us why you call them a space of exception? And secondly, speak a little more about the structural violence that is inflicted on the people who are living in these settlements.
So I do believe that slums are different. But acknowledging the difference does not necessarily make it an exception. So why do I call it a space of exception? So there are two reasons for it. One is firstly, the state turns the slum into a space of exception once it acknowledges it as a political entity which cannot have an agency. So first is you remove their agency. Now this removal of agency itself started with, I think, when the slum started becoming a big part of the voting public, I would say. I'll give you one interesting story. So this is as part of the slum sanitation program, which gave people options of different kinds of toilets, but people had to contribute towards them financially. We had politicians who very actively told people, "You contribute, karte? We will give you a free toilet." Okay. Now understand this: if this is a denial of agency, the imagination that people have a stake and can contribute. In fact, they are making the shelters, they are making the infrastructure in the settlement. Nobody has given them. The initial years of a slum settlement, I mean, they are spent in such a lot of struggle. I think many of us will not imagine this. The kind of struggle, staying without any infrastructure, staying without any amenities, gradually building these up, you know, in multiple ways, you know, and all lots of jugadu ways, but immense struggles. And in all of that, you come to a point and then you're recognized by the state, and then the state says, "Hey, we will give you. You have nothing to do with this." And this is the beginning of making an exception. When it comes to, therefore, then a policy like resettlement, then this thing of agency becomes complete, right? Firstly, at least they talked about some community participation and consent, that 70% people have to agree. Now it has come down to saying, No. They are slum dwellers. We are giving them rehabilitation. So it's not a matter of them giving a consent at all. Either they can be a part of the scheme or they can be out. Right? So now just look at what happens to the agency. And we are playing with this sense of agency, restricting all their other options, and then expecting them suddenly to become citizens. Because post-construction, post-redevelopment, then one says, okay, now you are a cooperative housing society, so you will take care of your maintenance, you have to pay for solid waste management, you have to pay your electricity bill. We prepare them for it. What have you done? What have you studied? Nothing. Okay? And I think this is how one creates the slum as a space for exception. Okay? Where the state creates an exceptional place, because definitely they have not been able to integrate the slums within the mainstream of society. They have only integrated it and created a incentive for the real estate market to grow. That's what has happened. Why is this a violent place, violent phenomenon? Why do I call it a structural violence? So here, firstly, I want to distinguish between violence and structural violence. There is lots of, firstly, violence also involved in the scheme. So we know the nexus of politics, bureaucracy, crime, very actively, which happens at various stages of the slum rehabilitation scheme. But perhaps going further than that explicit violence, physical violence, is really the story of structural violence. What is structural violence? The definition or the conceptual understanding of structural violence has 2-3 dimensions. Number one, it is a foreclosure, or it is a complete closure of options. Second, if one looks at the wider premise that people have to improve their own freedoms, okay, and they are struggling for that, then how is one, or how is the overall system behaving in a way that there are more enclosures, more barriers created towards that? Okay? So that's a very fascinating understanding of structural violence. Now, what are we doing with the slum rehabilitation? Number one, I already talked to you about the space question. From 8%, one is going down to 1/3, right? 33%, right? The second, no consent, no option, okay? But if you look at now the larger dimensions for this, earlier they had at least the freedom to stay put, right? There was a legitimation in some ways in the entire city. If you look at it as a child, I've grown up in this city, okay? But in Mumbai, I think the fascinating part is we don't consider a slum as out of place, right? Many of us get people who provide us services who stay in slums, and when they don't come or at other points in time, one would make visits also to the settlements. I have attended multiple marriage and other ceremonies as well, okay? Now, you are seeing therefore this as another part of the built environment, right? And there is a legitimacy. Okay, I stay in an apartment because I can afford it. There are still richer people who would stay in more luxury apartments, and there are poor people who don't afford it to stay in this settlement. Okay, what am I saying? There is a legitimation of a particular settlement, of why one stays where. What happens with the slum rehabilitation scheme? इनको तो फोकट में घर मिलता है, राइट? नाउ इफ यू लुक एट इट्स रिफ्लेक्शन इन द लॉ, द ज्यूरिसप्रूडेंस विच रिजल्ट्स, बिकॉज ज्यूरिसप्रूडेंस इन द मुंबई हाई कोर्ट्स, इफ यू बिगिन ट्रेसिंग इट, यू विल इंक्रीजिंगली सी दैट देयर इज अ क्लियर एंटी स्लम. Where they see what has been generated, find permanent options. Okay. There are so moto PIs which have been taken up, where in Bhiwandi there was a house collapse, right? And then one of the judges in Bombay High Court takes this up as a suo moto case, okay? And asks the state, why are there slums when you have so many acts, etc.? Penalize those officers, okay? Study from other countries' schemes and implement those here. And typically then there are three schemes cited, Singapore and whatever and whatever. Now, that is completely beyond. But what have you done in all of this business? Is basically said that, okay, slums ko to fukat ghar milta hai, and gareeb bechara middle class have to struggle all their way. So now middle class people also feel very antithetical. Tumko to fukat. मेरे बच्चे को स्ट्रगल करने लगे. सो यू अंडरस्टैंड दिस इज वेयर द वायलेंस बिकम्स मच मोर डीपर, एंड दैट इज व्हाट इज मोर डेंजरस टू द एग्जिस्टेंस ऑफ सेटलमेंट्स, राइट? इवन विद इन देमसेल्व्स देयर आर फाइट्स. आई रिमेंबर इन 2004-05 आई वाज विजिटिंग अ सेटलमेंट इन जोगेश्वरी, एंड देयर वाज अ एविक्शन इन प्रोग्रेस, एंड one lady from the settlement who was working as a primary health care worker, she came and received me on the bus stop, and I was saying, ye kya chal raha hai, apna kuch nahi hai didi, ye to 2011 ke baad 2001 ke baad ki hai. Now it is the person who is staying in that settlement who is ridiculing this part of the settlement because it is after 2001. Okay, at one point in time we were thinking of struggles of the slum dwellers, organizing them, right? And this is something else altogether, right? So I think when structures of society, when structures of law embed this kind of a hostility, they build in violence within them and delegitimate a phenomenon called slum, which actually has such intimate connections to you and me.
You know, I mean, this is going to be my last question. I actually had two, so I'm just going to combine them and ask. Firstly, you know, it would be great if you could speak about your work in the MBOT project. You know, we'd love to know about the work what it entails, in that particular project, the entire field action project. At least I'd love to know about it more. And the second thing, picking up on this violence bit, you also speak about hope, right? You also speak about the fact that despite living in these settlements and facing everyday violence of different forms from different actors, etc., you see these people making a claim to the city, you know, fighting for their inclusion, fighting for their acknowledgement. So there is still some hope left when, despite facing all of this, you have people going and making those small, leaving those small invisible footprints, like you call them, making a claim to the city. So, because I'd like to end this conversation with some amount of hope that, you know, despite the law being against them, you know, despite like all our processes being against these people, you still have, you know, these small wins every day that these people make. So could you please speak about that a bit, as well as, you know, your, perhaps, you know, some of your experience from the MBOT project that also indicates towards this? That would be great.
Thank you. So I'll talk about four aspects, and I hope I won't make it a very long answer, which I tend to do. But the first part, I think, of the MBOT project is basically that it was a build-up through the work of several of my PhD students, other researchers who were also associated, as well as activists who were associated. And I want to acknowledge at least a few of them. One is the work of Navtej Kaur Bhutani. He used to work with an organization called Yuva, and she was pursuing her PhD work. I was one of her supervisors. One of the things which really struck us and is that we are talking of MUTP at that point in time, the Mumbai Urban Transport Project, is creating a lot of resettlement. And somehow, all of that resettlement seems to be focused in particular areas of the city. And that happened to be the MEST ward. So with the MUTP and MUIP, there were about 100,000 households who were shifted from different parts of the city into one ward. Households, which means like an addition of at least 4 to 5 lakh population. Now this is huge, right? So this is something which struck us. Why does this happen? How does this happen? And which is where all of that slum TDR, etc., etc., kind of came. The second thing that we started looking at is, with this, it was not just the resettlement zoning which was happening, but we also saw till that time, till 2000 or so, there were only 2 SRA projects in the entire MEST. Because ये तो झोपड़पट्टियों का ward है, यहाँ पे कौन market क्या है, इसे who are the real estate players, etc., etc. But suddenly with MUIP and MUTP, the real estate market started opening up, okay? And you started also seeing other kinds of private developments over here, okay? So things which seemed non-penetrable by the real estate market suddenly became penetrable. The influence of the real estate on everyday life in settlements was huge. Okay? So for example, even in Basti's, where there is no legal water, where there is no legal electricity, okay, you see a 10 by 15 jhopda sells at more than 50,000. Now it is even more, but I'm just saying, this is about 10-15 years ago that I'm talking about. And which is what started shifting our mind. have been involved in the MEs ward since around 1985-90 or so, okay, with different organizations, not through this project kind of a mode. And the different organizations were doing very interesting work. So there is Apna Lay, there was Kodu, then different. Okay? But we started seeing that they are looking at it at a community level, okay, all changes which are happening. But what was happening now was really happening at a different scale of things. Okay? And which is why we conceptualized, yes, we need to think something about this, talk about larger questions of justice, okay, and therefore conceptualize change also at a ward, a administrative ward level. Now, which is very different. This is not an electoral ward, not a municipal ward. We are talking of an administrative ward, which in itself contains more than 10 municipal wards. Okay? So people are organized differently, but can we think, begin to think about the ward as a scale because of the kind of developments which are happening? Okay? Now that really became the entry point for the MWARD project. Okay? But beginning from there, then the MWARD project has moved into different realms. So at the time when we started the project, there were about 19 different communities in the entire MEs ward, which were constantly on the brink of eviction. Some of them were undergoing evictions multiple times a year. Okay? So where we have seen in the immediate wake of evictions, women delivering on the road, okay? Or children falling ill, dying, dropping out. In 2011, TISS did a study with several of its students and faculty, large numbers of faculty who were part of it. And one of the conclusions that this study drew was basically that there were things which were happening together. In bastis which were constantly being evicted, one also saw a low level of human development. These are the bastis where it is likely that there are going to be more maternal mortalities. These are the bastis where there are higher levels of malnourishment. These are the bastis where there will be larger numbers of school dropouts, okay, and so on and so forth. Okay. Now when this kind of a conclusion came, there is an insight into why does MEs ward have the lowest human development index in the entire city. So if one has to do something to transform these conditions, you have to do things at a multiple levels. Okay? So I'll just mention two scales of intervention and talk about that hope. One is the hope really that we have to build up on the agency that people have, and which was demonstrated in the kind of resistance to huge evictions which happened in the city in 2003-04. Because despite all of those evictions, people were protesting, people were participating in struggles, and we decided that we will be like the back office of some of these struggles. Okay? As a university, you cannot participate in struggles. Okay? So what does it mean by becoming a back office? Okay? We know that a struggle is an event, a protest is an event, but you still have children who are dropping out, your children who are unable to get registered in schools. Okay? So we started community education centers for them in those bastis which were getting evicted. Okay? Which also meant that our community centers would also get evicted when the basti got evicted. Okay? And we recreate again. Okay? So that is like one of the things that we began doing. The other part of this agency, very interestingly, we saw that people are constantly kind of innovating on things. Okay? Open space. There is big amounts of open space in any sport, but which is completely inaccessible to people. So it is all within the boundaries of the BRC, or these are mangroves which are now declared forests, so you can't go there. Okay? So these kind of green areas. So how do you create interesting spaces? How do you make them accessible to people? And we tried experimenting in one of the settlements. Fortunately, we had a very interesting assistant commissioner at that time who came with us to the basti. Children performed a program and he said, bachchas have no place to play. Okay? And he said, what do you want? He said, we want two truckloads of debris. Okay? So he gave us two truckloads of debris. We leveled up some land there. volunteers in the Basti put up interesting play equipment. We had lots of challenges with the play equipment. Like we had created a tire ka jhula, and then Buffalo came in and took the jhula along with her. But I think these were interesting because these are all things which were sourced from within the Basti, created by Basti. So we work a lot with these kind of interim solutions at one level. Secondly, we also mediate and talk to the municipal corporation and see what can be done. For example, we have done mapping of toilets and seen if a toilet, how many people use it? Where is it that toilets are required really, honestly? So it's like these, we really play the role of a knowledge support agency. The second level and second scale of intervention is really, I think, what we did in the development plan. And we are keeping on building up on that. But during the development plan, obviously because we don't mark slums, MEAST perhaps had the largest numbers of exclusions from the ward. But we were able to educate, train people into mapping their own communities, trying to trace that onto the proposed land use plan, the existing land use plans first, then the proposed land use plans, try to argue for some kind of inclusions. And there are fascinating, I think, ideas. Many of our people became good mappers, and there were so many hidden talents which also came out at that time, like people who had taken draftsman training, but who then participated in actually mapping their entire community. So fun things. And we were able to talk to the scale of a city. We were successful to the extent that even today, the entire development plan report for Mumbai has a special section on the MWOD. There is a special thing there, and which talks about how the entire social amenities in the ward need to be enhanced. Because our main question was, hey, this is a ward where the state itself is not thinking about any strategies for how to improve the development index. Like when we started work, there were only two secondary municipal schools in the entire ward. Okay? So you have a ward of over 800,000 populations and two secondary municipal schools, which means that you want the students to only learn till primary level. Right? So you have these kind of exclusions which are built in. So it's a mix of advocacy, some action on the ground, some knowledge generation products and so on.
Thank you so much, Dr. Dhirin. I think before I open up the floor to the audience for questions, I think what I'm taking back from this conversation personally is a few things. One is, of course, you know, again, on the law and policy side, our planning laws need to be revamped. And like you said, the planning law, which now accounts for a general public interest. I mean, I think the provisions on sending comments also, there's just one provision that says you can send in comments to the draft development plan. And there is no mention about whether they are even bound to accept those suggestions, reject those suggestions.
Or even call for hearings.
So there's like a very skeletal provision which is there in the planning law, which of course needs to be strengthened. And of course, I think the idea behind a planning law, I mean, we need to shift our approaches to, like you said, a right to the city conversation sort of thing, you know, that everybody who lives in a city has a right to that city, and let's plan our cities taking everybody into account as opposed to only people who have property. I think that's the one takeaway I have when it comes to planning of our cities. The second sort of takeaway that I have from this, especially on the Slum Act and the Slum Rehabilitation Project, is that we need to have an umbrella of solutions, like you said, under our slum laws. You know, you want to redevelop them, rehabilitate them, but also give them other options, you know, in order to sort of get out of that entire situation. You know, perhaps like you said, take up self-redevelopment. So an umbrella of options under our slum laws, and not just a very single-minded focus on rehabilitation and redevelopment. And I think also the other thing that goes with it is this de-linking that needs to happen, some sort of a delinking, not a complete delinking, between development incentives that, you know, the market decides and rehabilitation projects. That's the second thing that I'm taking with it. And I think the third thing, which is more on the violence, you know, how we legitimize these settlements around us, we just accept it as a way of life. Like you said, is that some people live in slums. You know, these people who work for you, you know, are probably cooking for you, are probably looking after your houses, are making sure that each of us get to our work and, you know, generate all of this economic activity, go to office, go to work, etc. The people, you know, guarding your buildings in the night. All of these people perhaps live in these settlements, and we are just okay with the fact that they live in these settlements because, you know, too bad, they can't afford it. So this sort of like legitimization that happens on an everyday basis, we have to be more conscious about it in our everyday lives and perhaps not just take it as a given and see if there is a way in which we can, you know, sort of contribute, you know, to alleviating their condition in some way. I think that's the sort of like third takeaway that I have. I will now open the floor for the audience, you know, for questions.
This is an excellent introduction because I think, you know, credit goes to the young advocate, but more importantly is, you know Dr. Bide's, you know, experience in, from Tata Institute, you know, because, you know, I represent an organization known as Citizen for Just Society, which was founded by Dr. Usha Mehta Gandhi. I will not question anything because we dealt with micro as well as macro level and everything about the slum and, you know, way back to our, you know, pre-independence and today's slum. But I want to tell you what we did it as a Citizen for Just Society, which you did not dealt with the biggest slum encroaching rival land. So we relocated, rehoused, rehabilitated 53,000 families at one go. But it took us almost 11 to 12 years of struggle, what you said. But there are many slums which need to be relocated, rehoused, rehabilitated. Not only Dharavi. Dharavi is becoming the biggest controversy as of today. It is a big controversy. Maybe we will be intervening into the Supreme Court. That's another thing. But the point what I want to say is that, you know, you are not connected the violence into corruption, because the corruption is the biggest issue as of today. Because see, Tata Institute has done several research as well as fact finding. One is corruption in the encroachment on the footpaths by the harpers. It's something, you know, which I don't know what law will find solution. This is what, you know, I have in with. You know, there are a lot of things which you came out excellent. You, because I think your finding must go to World Bank, because, you know, we dealt with World Bank, because MTP project 1, 2, 3 is the one who is replaced to all these stuff of railway infrastructure. We have done only one part of it, 10 meters this way, 10 meters this way, because this, whatever the judgment came from the High Court is open, because the slums are still have. So that's how we work with World Bank, 8,500 crore rupees project. So, and this also happened to be replicated elsewhere in the same, and Calcutta and, you know, Delhi, Dubai's big story.
Thank you so much. So I had a couple of questions. One was on the forms of clean making, because that's something which has kind of confused me or excited me for multiple at different points in time. Actually, like, how do we think about embedding this idea of retrofitting, upgradation, incremental approach in actually policy and lawmaking, right? For example, like, when theorizing, I feel, is one thing, but then when we actually think about embedding it in actual implementation, which is binding by law, that's when it gets tricky, right? And a couple of examples which comes to my mind is the slum networking project of Ahmedabad, which gave a 10-year no eviction guarantee without having titles. Or what Panyat Samiti Sita Dada is doing, where the incremental approach towards getting legal access to water is a one step towards security, right? So what are the other ways we can think of? That's one part. And second one is the idea of scale, right? You talked about water as a scale. Now, you know, you're like, so, you know, we kind of started an initiative, Center for Inclusive Habitat, where we try to go with the idea of slum self-redevelopment. If we can, you know, collate together a community and then maybe find some local contractor and then do, like, where the society acts as a developer. So where we are thinking at a local sort of a small settlement as a scale, but then it got very tricky because I had to like literally risk my life, run away from goons and stuff. I went into all that mess and then somehow I burnt my hands a little bit. But I was like let it be like a literacy platform, right? Now, how do you define that scale when it comes to thinking from a non-institutional perspective, but more like as someone who is at an individual scale or a set of researchers who are trying to do that? So yeah.
I'm from Karnataka, so I run community health centers called Tantric in slums. So it took the pandemic for me to realize that slums need specialized healthcare. So I wanted to understand what are the policies in place where medical education slums are protected, there is some sort of restriction in the way medicine is practiced in slums. Is there anything at all? Because there are a lot of unregistered practitioners. Secondly, are there any legal aspects that even doctors must know so that they can actually enter slums and look at it from a community health point of view? So ME's ward, so I'm from KEM, so we are posted there. So that was the first time in my life of being a citizen in Mumbai, I saw that kind of. So I think that kind of approach is lacking even in medicine. So I wanted to understand how to build healthier cities. Because, yeah, that's...
Okay, in terms of claims, I think there are official claims, officially acknowledged claims, and there are unacknowledged claims. And I think one needs to look at that entire range perhaps. For example, when I gave you that example of the play space that we created. Okay. Now it is a unofficial space created through the collaboration of an official with a NGOized or community. But whether these kind of claims have meaning, they do. Okay. So there is that one kind of claim. And I'm just trying to build like a continuum of these kind of claims. And these help because in the long run, some of these get stabilized, some of these get institutionalized. Okay? They will not really necessarily result into something which is always non-problematic. Sometimes they may also result in highly problematic issues. But I think there is an importance to them. The second thing I feel is what are also a whole lot of official practices which are there, and this is a big learning in MWOD. So if you look at the Municipal Act, we didn't talk about the Municipal Acts per se. Okay? So I find it fascinating ki if you read through the entire text of the Municipal Act, there is no word slum mentioned there. Okay? So what the Municipal Act talks of is encroachments, nuisance, these kind of things. Okay? So how do municipal commissioners, assistant commissioners act? If you go to any municipal office, the municipal office is full of not necessarily middle class residents, but largely different kinds of agents and people from. So, I think to me, it's a question of everyday ethics, and clearly different assistant commissioners are using their own brand of ethics to navigate through the situations that they are encountering. But this also helps to legitimate certain claims and delegitimize certain claims. Okay? Again, very important. For example, how do you respond to illegalities even done by so-called elites, right? This city is full of that, right? Or all cities, rather, right? So I think when I look at claim making, I look at it really as a whole continuum, okay? I also see it, claim making, as a very dynamic process, okay? I'm trying to combine maybe some elements of a response to Dr. Malvika. where there are like a whole lot of informal schools which are run, a lot of informal clinics, hospitals which are run. What is the corporation's response to this? In June every year, it will prepare a list of schools which should be closed down, which are unregistered, and उनको लगता है कि ये paper आ गया मतलब closed. Or if there is a woman who dies in one of these hospitals, then they will come and shut down these hospitals. 7 days बंद रहता है, another license, another name. And the same thing, so doctors are the same, the infra is the same, and these things continue. Okay, now I feel ki when one is looking at all of these kind of situations, as I said, ki this is a problematic thing, right? Ki something which started as a informal self-help, and the only kind of operators because the public health system is not reaching out, so ye ek claim hai. But it is or not always a sustainable kind of a claim. To corporators providing services, those are claims, right? And I think therefore there is a space for all of these kind of claims, right? The scale of organization you were wanting to differentiate, is there space for an individual action within a ward level imagination? I do think both of these and many interim levels also have their space. For example, there are certain actions that you can take up at a ward level. Okay? One of the things, like we are looking at a budget, municipal budget, is analyzed only centrally, and it is, I think, in the last few years that there is a more clearer ward level disaggregation which is given. So it becomes a space for aggregation there. You can't break it down at a sub-ward level. We don't have that kind of data available. We don't have those kind of allocations available. Okay? So there are certain actions, as I'm saying, which are only possible when you look at ward, and ward gives you the jump to the city person. Okay? There are other scales, for example, evictions ho rahe hain, mobilization karna hai, service karni, you will need to go below. Right, at the community, perhaps even sub-community, one small cluster kind of a level. And in all of these, I'm sure, because I've seen so many entrepreneurs within slums. Okay? So individuals do have their space. Okay? I think when you equate your issues are also as a person who is taking on extremely difficult issues. And as an outsider who is partly understanding some of the dynamics, partly not used to it. So that's how.
Imagination the public health system may have, they are not there.
I mean,
my question to you is, considering the fact that slums have obvious value, you've talked about it post the decline of industrialization in Mumbai also. You've given examples of Dharavi, how there are industrial and commercial values. For the middle class, for the upper middle class, it's a service value because you have people from there coming and serving people in those areas. So there's an obvious value attached to slums, despite which they're looked at as a problem which needs to be solved. Now, one example which you gave during your discussion was, look at it from a rights-based approach. Look at it as a right to a city. That's how you can ensure improvement of the quality. Is there any other form of value that you can ascribe to a slum, apart from commercial value, which could aid in long-term development as far as slums and the people in the slums are concerned?
Difficult question to ask. There have been some studies which have focused purely on what is the economic contribution of slums. Okay. Now, doing the economic contribution of slums or the informal sector is a very difficult exercise because typically the valuation given to these forms of labor is also very low value. Right? Like if you are paying a domestic worker, let's say 2000 rupees per month, is that her true value? Or is it a negotiated value because these are very unequal stakes, right? So therefore, a simple summation of all earnings is not what can be constituted as value, right? So there have been some studies like this. There are other studies which have looked at the larger productivity of a city, for example, the GDP or whatever. We don't unfortunately have city GDPs in India. We are not that decentralized at all. But thinking about the GDP and thinking about all of the people who service us as slaves. Okay? So for example, my efficiency as a professor is enabled by at least 5 slaves. Right? There is a person who comes and cooks for me. There is a person who comes and cleans the house. Right? If one has to look at park roles, there is a istriwala, there is a dudwala, and these are all easing the burdens and making me more efficient, right? So these are also valuations which are actually ideas which have been given from the Brazilian and the Latin American context, where they have tried to look at some alternate value system. So what is your share in terms of the efficiency, the overall productivity, and seeing from that point of view, so that you are not compelled to value this through wages, which can be depressed.
अभी जैसे आपने कहा कि जो slum है, उस slum में 30 माले की building बना दिया, तो slum में जो लोग रहते हैं, वो तो बाहर चले जाएंगे। लेकिन जो slum में जो लोग रहने गए, उनको किन लोगों ने बसाया? आपने कभी इस बात की स्टडी किया है क्या? नंबर एक, जो लोग स्लम बना रहे हैं, चाहे मालवनी हो, कपरेड हो, धारावी हो, जोगेश्वरी का कुछ इलाका है या गोरेगांव का कुछ इलाका है, तो जो लोग भी स्लम बसा रहे हैं वो कौन है? किसी ना किसी पॉलिटिकल पार्टी से कनेक्टेड, नंबर एक। अब जो लोग उस स्लम को रीडेवलप कर रहे हैं वो कौन लोग हैं? वो भी किसी ना किसी पॉलिटिकल पार्टी के बिल्डर है, दो हो गया। अब जो लोग रह रहे हैं उनके बारे में आपने कह दिया कि हमारी जीवन को सफल बनाने के लिए वो लोग काम करते हैं, तो अब वो उनके पास रहने की व्यवस्था नहीं है, तो वो जो दो लोग हैं, एक आदमी जो सरकारी जमीन को कब्जा करना चाहता है, नंबर एक। नंबर दो, अब जो आदमी सरकार में बैठा है वही मकान बना रहा है और वही अपने फायदे के लिए, जैसे यहाँ समझो 100 आदमी है, उसमें से 30 आदमी को मकान दे दिया, 70 को बोला कि अनफिट है और वो 70 को बेच दिया और बोल दिया भाई फिर सलम का सलम ही रहेगा। तो मेरा क्वेश्चन ये है आपसे कि इसमें पब्लिक का जो रोल है, वो पब्लिक अपना रोल क्यों नहीं करती? क्योंकि जैसे स्कूल की भी आपने जिक्र की है, अब वो दिल्ली में देखिए सरकारी स्कूल ठीक हो गए, वार्ड वाइज सरकारी स्कूल ठीक हो गए हैं, पंजाब में भी सरकारी स्कूल ठीक हो गए हैं, गवर्नमेंट के हॉस्पिटल भी ठीक हो गए हैं, दिल्ली में भी गवर्नमेंट के हॉस्पिटल ठीक हो गए हैं, लेकिन मुंबई में खास तौर पे, जबकि मुंबई का जो बजट है म्युनिसिपल कॉर्पोरेशन का किसी स्टेट से ज़्यादा है, और फिर भी यहाँ प्रॉब्लम सेम है। तो मेरा आपसे क्वेश्चन यही है कि यहाँ वार्ड वाइज अगर ये प्रॉब्लम को सॉल्व करना है तो कैसे सॉल्व किया जा सके?
So ma'am, we talked about agency a lot. The government taking agency can be done away with some legislation, some smart legislation. But there is also a part of commercial entities taking away the agency. Like I work in a slum in Rabare, where there is a company called Sharplex who gets employment out of the slum. So they monitor the wage at such a level that they don't give enough wage, of course. A couple there, two people working there earn around 10,000 a month, which is not enough, of course. But it completely dissuades the majority of the people from seeking actual rehabilitation or actual development. So what can be done about that sort of taking away of the agency?
Very, very concrete example. I think the best situation would have been if employers also gave a little bit of value to their employees, all sectors of employees. Typically what happens is there is only an upper echelon of employees for whom we now think of work integrated housing, etc. Okay. यहाँ पे पास में तो होना चाहिए because workers have to be available for all the shifts or whatever the industry may be working. But on the other hand, one is depressing their value, right? So I think the real solution to some of the, and I agree with you that this is a taking away of agency. But even in the first case that I talked about agency, the state plays a big role in relation to the law, in terms of the interpretation or formulating the law. But definitely it is also serving market interest, right? So I think law is also a representation. If one takes the Lefebvrean thinking, it's also a mythification of our actual reality, right? So one will need to contest this at multiple levels. No? Do employers have some kind of a duty to their employees, right? Otherwise, what is one doing? Employers have shirked off responsibility, including today public sector employees. And then to fulfill the housing need, one is actually creating these more gentrified, displacing kind of formulations. Right?
You talked about the general public interest, general public interest for planning, where we don't see planning for everyone. But don't you think that generalization is rather an inclusion for everyone, where I'm not segregating each and every group, but inclusion of all of them?
And maybe give a little bit theoretical answer to you.
I've not talked theory so far.
But this is in the words of somebody called Lefebvre. Okay? Lefebvre was a French social political scientist. And one of the things that he talked about is planning is like a mythification. Okay. One creates a myth of diagrams, maps, okay, and which is much more difficult to understand rather than the very concrete, hard-hitting questions that the person from the last asked. Okay. Because these are the same questions, and in this name, one can mythify. Okay. I think this interpretation of general public interest is something like that. Whose public interest it is, and Lefebvre demonstrates to us in some ways, that this public interest is really the interest which may be influenced by who the planner is, planner's own class in some ways. Okay? The planner's own class and subjectivity is as embedded in the politico-economic social system that the planner is part of. And only because it takes the form of maps and other kinds of perhaps mathematical values that it becomes a intellectually expressed representation which is objective. Now, is that really objective? Is the question, right? And how do we take on this kind of politics? Is perhaps by opening this up, okay? So when I said there should be no general public, that's not how I say that there should be a segregated public interest for everybody, okay? But can there be a explicit order which says that planning has to be inclusive, planning has to be participative, that planning cannot displace? If we can set up these kind of principles, which are like first order principles, you will need to take some of these things off, right? Then you will have to visibilize all the existing land uses, and not just the land uses which are legitimated by property ownership, right? मैं बिल्कुल सहमत हूँ आपसे कि जो proponent होता है slum का, वो कभी पॉलिटिकल पार्टी से हो सकता है, वो कभी रियल एस्टेट का हो सकता है, वो कोई बिल्डर कभी कभी हो सकता है, क्योंकि ये सब चीजें हुई है मुंबई के पूरे इतिहास में। लेकिन सवाल ये है कि जैसे जैसे इसका ट्रैजेक्टरी बढ़ता है, आप देखोगे कि जो वहां पे रहते हैं उनका खुद का भी एक आयुष्य वहां पे बन जाता है, एंड दैट इज क्रिटिकल। सो ओवर अ पीरियड ऑफ टाइम आर वी एबल टू डिस इंसेंटिवाइज दीज इंटरेस्ट एंड इंटरेस्ट एंड इंस्टेड एनकरेज द लार्जर इंटरेस्ट, द मास इंटरेस्ट देयर, दैट इज द पॉइंट। ओनली देन यू विल बी एबल टू सी दैट देयर इज अ चेंज इन द सिचुएशन। अभी ये स्लम रिहैब जैसे स्कीम क्या करती है, वो वही जो ओरिजिनल इंटरेस्ट है ना उसको पकड़ के उसको बढ़ावा देती है, इसलिए वो गलत है। मैं एक कंपैरिजन करके आपको एक दो सिचुएशंस का बता दें। सांगली में हमारे एक दोस्त है, और सांगली में बहुत सारी जगह पे गुंठेवारीज बनी है, और ये गुंठेवारीज का स्वरूप जो है वो पहले बिल्कुल स्लम्स के जैसा था। कैसे? कि अर्बन लैंड सीलिंग एक्ट आया, लैंड ओनर्स को अपनी जमीन नहीं दी थी, देनी दी थी गवर्नमेंट को, क्योंकि वो बहुत बहुत ही कम प्राइस उसके लिए दे रहे थे। तो इसलिए लैंड ओनर्स ने क्या किया कि अपने यहाँ चालिया बनाई, और सॉरी प्लॉट्स ही बेचे लोगों के, जो मिलेगा प्राइस उसको बेच दी, प्लॉट्स छोटे छोटे प्लॉट्स बना के। सो सोचो कि एक एकड़ की जमीन है, तो एक एकड़ की जमीन पे यू कैन मैक्सिमली अकॉर्डिंग टू प्लानिंग नॉर्म्स हैव टू और थ्री रेगुलर प्लॉट्स। तो यहाँ पे 100 प्लॉट्स बन गए, और ये 100 प्लॉट्स में लोग रहने को आए। एट दैट पॉइंट इन टाइम इट बिकेम अफोर्डेबल हाउसिंग। लेकिन ये सांगली की सिचुएशन के लिए गवर्नमेंट ने बोला कि ये स्लम नहीं है, ये क्या है, गुंठेवारी है। और गुंठेवारी बोल के उन्होंने क्या किया, ये हरेक को लैंड ओनर करके रिकॉग्नाइज किया। मुंबई में ऐसी सिचुएशन जब आई तब उन्होंने स्लम डिक्लेयर किया। अभी स्लम का डिक्लेरेशन जो है वो स्लम ओनर की रियलिटी को बिल्कुल डिलीट करता है। सांगली में उन्होंने एनकरेज किया उनको। आर यू गेटिंग टू अंडरस्टैंड दीज टू डायनामिक्स? सो ये कहां से शुरू हुआ, ये प्रश्न को महत्व है, लेकिन वो प्रश्न जो है हम उसको कॉन्टेस्ट कर सकते हैं, उसको डिलीट कर सकते हैं थ्रू पॉलिसी।
थैंक यू सो मच मैम। आई थिंक इट वॉज, आई मीन पर्सनली फॉर मी अ वेरी वेरी इंसाइटफुल डिस्कशन, एंड आई एम गोइंग टू बी टेकिंग बैक अ लॉट, आई थिंक यू नो, टू थिंक अबाउट टुडे बेस्ड ऑन व्हाट यू सेड ऑन हाउ लॉज, ऑन हाउ आर लॉज एंड पॉलिसीज यू नो कैन सॉर्ट ऑफ एड्रेस दिस पर्टिकुलर इशू। We wish to see you soon. We'll keep you posted about our second conversation, which will happen in a couple of months' time. And I hope to see some of you soon as well.